and a series of solid thumps, and it popped off and clattered to the concrete. The red glare of the night was too dim to show me anything until I drew out my mother's pentacle amulet, sent a whisper of will into it, and set it aglow with azure wizard light. The inside of the beam isn't made of metal. It's all a wooden framework and looks more like the hold of an old pirate ship. The interior of the beam was piled high with mil-spec weapons cases and boxes of ammunition, secure on a sturdy internal framework, just right in the middle of Millennium Park. "You got a hell of a lot of nerve, Mab," I murmured. And her voice whispered in my ear as if she'd been standing flush against me. "Thank you, my knight. It is a fine compliment." I jumped and hit my head on the low opening and backed up enough to glower at her. Mab turned her eyes away from me and said, "Do battle as you will, my knight. Take command of your mortals and what few servants of winter were near enough to join us." Her gaze returned to the northeast, where the red pulse of the eye flashed again. "Make the Fomor bleed. You will know the time to come to me." It was a clear dismissal, and Mab's tone made it obvious that she was done with my shenanigans. But I'm not so much the kind who gets easily dismissed, not even by the Queen of Air and Darkness. I went to her side, where I noticed that even the unicorn's hooves were set up like cruel, spiked maces, and said, "This banner.
Few knights have had the strength to manifest it. You never spoke to me about it. Would you have listened?"
"Well, touche, I guess."
"I can feel them," I said, "the people following me."
Mab closed her eyes for a moment, then she said,
"Yes, such is the rule of winter."
"And when they die, I'll feel that too."
"Obviously," Mab said in a near whisper, "for all power there is a price."
I shuddered. My soul had already taken a beating in the past few days. I don't know that I needed to add on the psychic experience of living through hundreds of deaths to my list of mental scars. I gritted my teeth. I could take a little more if I had to. And I had to. A lot more people were going to die if we didn't stop the enemy here. I glanced aside at Mab and frowned. Did she feel it too? Her command of her subjects, of me? Did she feel it when they died? Did she carry their pain, their rage, their terror upon the back of her own soul? Or whatever it was that passed for one now? Did she even have a soul anymore?
"I was mortal once."
I've been waiting for Mab to lay into me with a magically enhanced temptation, the usual trappings and blandishments of corruption. I'd been expecting her, every time we met, to start putting me through Sith boot camp, the Kurgan's Guide to Conflict Resolution, Evil 101. The whole time, I'd been wondering, what happens when she does? The far more terrifying question had never once occurred to me. What happens when she doesn't? Maybe the process of becoming something horrible wasn't about temptation to sin, forbidden delights, and bad impulse control. Maybe it was about choosing to throw your soul into a meat grinder over and over again, until what remained couldn't even be seen as a soul any longer. Maybe the real monsters, the big bad monsters, aren't created. They're forged, hammered, one blow at a time.
"I was mortal once."
Mab opened her eyes again at last. The look she gave me was, for a second, very human. One weary, determined soldier staring at another. I had, in her eyes, passed some kind of test, some rite that had changed my status. And it terrified me.
The real battle for your own soul isn't about falling from a great height. It's about descending, or not, one choice at a time. And sometimes, it's about choosing to pay a price so someone else doesn't have to. I had rarely hesitated to hazard my body in the defense of those who needed it. I look back at the city behind us. If more is required of me, so be it. I offered my hand to Mab, plain soldier. She took it. Chapter 19. I put Sonya and Murphy on getting the arms out to the volunteers. Marcone had planned as if he'd intended a city block party's worth of amateurs to be kitted out with the one weapon that could do the most damage in their hands, shotguns. A hell of a lot of shotguns. And given the haze over the city, it wasn't like anyone could see clearly more than 30 or 40 yards anyway. Not everyone took a shotgun. Dozens had heavier weapons of their own. But by the time we were done, everyone had a firearm of some type, and everyone had pockets full of shells. I called Toot Toot in and sent him with a message for Etri. Within 5 minutes of sending the little guy off, a squad of Svartov combat engineers arrived, and I'd given them their instructions. They immediately turned to the open earth inside the pavilion and began shaping it into defensible earthworks beneath the enormous arching trellis that supported the pavilion's sound system. People stared at that in awe. It's not often you see several hundred thousand tons of earth moving itself around thanks to the hand gestures of a crew of little gray guys. "Defilady enough for you?" I asked Sonya. "Ah," the Russian replied. "Did not know this park was built on styrofoam at bottom." "Yeah, the whole place is technically kind of a rooftop garden," I said. "Can you hold?"
"Maybe, but then they go around us," Sonya said.
"We leave 1/3 here. The rest we go out and find them. Draw them back here if we have to fall back.
They run across all this open space?
Pow, pow. Video game easy."
"If you have to fall back, huh?" I said. The big man grinned.
"Da, I'm Russian. We are very positive people," Sonya said.
"No, you aren't," came Butters' protest from somewhere off in the haze.
Sonya beamed.
"I really like little Jedi man," he confided.
"Here, look."
He leaned down to scrape at loose earth with the tip of his knife.
"Mab here, us here. Enemy coming from there, there, there."
He made marks to the north, east, and south.
"See? Our people will hold against north threat from earthworks. Others go out, see if we can hit the east threat from flank once they engage Mab."
He nodded toward the mark on the south.
"That one up to the archive and Etri's people."
I nodded.
"You'll just be wandering around blind out there."
"Duh, but so are they. So it is fair."
"What kind of idiot wants to fight fair?" I complained.
"This is terrible fight," Sonya said. "But it's only one we have. Fair is many steps up ladder from where we are now."
"Good point," I said with a grimace. I frowned and checked. My contingent of wicked fae, who were lurking out of sight of the mortals, had approximately tripled in size, mainly with Malks. I knew there was a big colony of them in town. And now I had a good 70 of the vicious little killers slinking around the haze and waiting for a chance to spill more blood. None of them were near the mortals who had followed me, which is what I mostly worried about. "Hey," I thought, as loud as I could, in the direction of Winter, "the mortals of Chicago are off limits. Cross me on this, and I'll kill every last one of you." What came back to me from the creatures of Winter was a sensation of, well, it wasn't compliance. It was deeper than that. My will became their will. I felt the adjustment of their very beings. Their rising fury at the suffering inflicted upon. The closest thing I could come up with to explain it was that they felt the same rage a farmer does when something is after his livestock.
Maybe that's as close to being protective as winter gets. But it was hard and cold and real. The winter knight doesn't so much lead winter's troops as command them as he would any other weapon in his grasp. I sent Malks out in a circular screen around us. I wanted to know when the enemy got close and the little killers were silent and swift as any wraith. Murphy was demonstrating to a group of volunteers how to load a shotgun. It's not real complicated. When it comes to firearms, shotguns are about as basic as it gets. She finished showing a number of drawn, determined faces how to handle the weapon. "For what we're doing," she said to the volunteers, "you've got about the best weapon you can reasonably get. It'll shoot farther than you can see, and it'll be hard to miss. Tuck it in tight to your shoulder and aim down the barrel. You have 4 rules.
Never point your weapon at anything you don't want dead.
Know your target so you don't shoot your neighbor. Know what's behind your target so you don't shoot your neighbor by accident. And for God's sake, keep your finger off the damn trigger until you followed rules 1 through 3. She held up her right forefinger. You put this on the trigger. Assume you are a deadly weapon and a threat to anything you're facing, period. Clear? There was a round of murmured affirmatives. I walked up behind her and said, I need your advice. Murphy passed a shotgun to a nervous volunteer, a young man who said, That's all we get? Plenty of soldiers have gotten less, I said to him. If you want to run, head west. The enemy is coming in from all around us everywhere else. The kid swallowed, nodded, and carefully kept his finger off the trigger. Murphy clapped him on the shoulder, and then we turned to walk a little distance away. What do I do? I asked her quietly. How do I arrange this so that I don't get all these people killed? Trust Sonya, she said frankly. He's had some military experience. Neither of us does. That's the best we've got. I looked over to where the Russian was talking to some guys in uniforms, laughing, his deep voice, the laughter itself clear and somehow silvery. The air around him seemed less hazy than elsewhere, and I could read the faces of the people around him well enough to see that the Knight of the Sword's presence was combating the supernatural fear and frenzy in the air around them. They just looked more like people when they stood near Sonya. Right, I said. I walked forward to stand next to Sonya, cleared my throat, and spoke out in what I hoped was a clear, firm voice. All right, people, gather in. They did. I was tall enough for everyone to see.
Had never really occurred to me why everyone thought military leaders should be tall.
It simply offered a practical advantage for much of humanity's history. They could see my face, my eyes. They could see me. This city has gone to hell in the handbasket, I declared. And then a bunch of monsters showed up. There was a rumble of nervous laughter. Chicagoans love their city. But they also have few illusions about how screwed up it can be. They live here. I know you're scared, I said. I know you've all seen things that nobody should have to see. I pushed the image of that damned crib out of my head. I know you don't know who I am, and this is all weird. So, let me introduce myself. My name is Harry Dresden. I'm a wizard of the White Council, and I mean to fight to the death to defend this town. What? Came an incredulous voice from the crowd. You think you're a what? I turned to that voice, identified the speaker through my link to the banner, and strode directly toward him. People got out of my way. He was a skinny guy, late 30s, holding a hunting rifle. He drew back half a pace apprehensively as I approached. What's your name, man? I asked. It's Randy. Okay, Randy, I'm only going to do this once. I dropped my staff to the ground, held up my hands in front of me, palms facing each other, drew in a whisper of will, and murmured, Agus Chenus. Green gold lightning, not a ton of it, exploded from my palms, forming a current of energy that snapped and crackled in the sultry summer air, contained within the space between my hands. I had thought through the spell before, but I'd never really tried it. It worked pretty well. except that rather than just going away, the power was cycling up one arm, around my shoulders, down the other arm, and then out between my hands again. It was a cycle that fed upon itself, and between that and the power-laden air of a terrified city, the energy built a whole hell of a lot faster than I would have liked. It had to go somewhere. I picked a tree and unleashed a stroke of green lightning that smashed into the trunk about 5 feet up and brought the tree crashing down. It started burning with green flame. Green flame. All hell was breaking loose. I could only attribute that to the breakdown in reality that Bob had warned me about. My volunteers had fallen silent. Randy looked like he'd swallowed multiple bugs. Wizard, I reiterated. Any questions?
Are you on our side?
Randy asked. If you're here to defend the innocent, damn Skippy, I'm on your side, I said. I grabbed his shoulder and squeezed a little, and I turned to look at everyone else. The monsters are coming, I said, and they'll kill everyone in this town if they can, unless we kill them first. The crowd let out a sound that was a lot like a hungry growl. I found myself smiling more and more widely. Yeah, the world was full of monsters and demons, but it was a human world. It was our world, because we were the cleverest, most resourceful, and most dangerous things in it. Maybe my little army wasn't the most martial representation of humanity, but people fighting for their homes had historically done incredible things. Time for history to repeat itself.
Sonya. Raise your hand.
He did. This is Sonya. He's a knight. He fights monsters for a living, and he knows what he's talking about. Sonya is your commander. Sonya, hey, where the hell did you get a freaking Kalashnikov?
Sonya shouldered his rifle by its strap, grinning.
Found it.
I waved a hand at him.
Whatever. Take charge, man.
Da, Sonya said, and raised his voice to a bellow.
Hello. First of all, da, I am Russian.
Cope.
Second, you see these men and women in uniforms. Easy to recognize, even in haze, da? They are your officers. I will make groups of about 30. Each group get one officer. Officer tell you what to do, you do it.
Sonya turned to the uniformed men and women.
You guys get to give one of three orders. Stand, retreat, and follow me. Keep it simple. Communications in battle are hard, even for professionals.
There was a round of nods. The military folks looked grim. They knew what a clusterfuck they were about to march into. And I knew how hard it was to convey even simple ideas in a fight. We'd be lucky if the volunteers could follow even those limited orders reliably.
Sonya turned back to the crowd.
Everywhere we go tonight, assume that you have orders to kill the enemy on sight. If standing and the enemy comes, kill enemy. If retreating, kill enemy. If following officer and the enemy comes, kill enemy.
Sonya considered.
Basically, tonight, we're always killing enemy.
Another laugh at that. But he was playing to an easy room. People who are scared need to laugh, and the scarier things are, the more they need it.
Okay, Sonya called. Officer, we'll divide you into groups. Everyone keep quiet so you can hear them.
Sonya and his officers started getting them sorted out. I shivered a little and stepped over to one side where I could close my eyes for a second and try to process everything that was happening. I felt Murphy come up behind me and then lean against me. I leaned back. This is going to be ugly, isn't it? I said quietly. Yes, Murphy said simply. Just remember whose fault it is. There was a horrible shrieking sound and the haze flared red. This time I could hear the building falling again. Ethniu was walking straight down Lakeshore, knocking down buildings like a kid kicking over anthills. She was coming for Mab.
who was, in essence, using herself as bait to keep the Titan from noticing me. I found Murphy's hand and squeezed gently. What's going to happen after this, do you think? I don't, she said, because I'm doing today first. I snorted quietly. Murphy squeezed back. Harry, you can't fix tomorrow until it gets here.
Which is weird because you can screw it up from decades away.
I heard her laugh gently. I got used to weird. It's not so bad. Flattery is unworthy of you, I said. It's definitely unworthy of one of us.
I opened my mouth to fire back like Sir Benedict would have wanted me to, but instead I had to deal with a sudden harsh, twisting, feline voice radiating through my skull.
Sir Knight,
mewled the unsettling voice of the Malk.
This is Grey Malkin.
Right. Grey Malkin was Mab's personal aide in some ways.
He was an elder of the Malks, which meant he was bigger and stronger and meaner than most, and had access to a number of powers, foremost of which was the ability to creep me out with his damn weird voice.
The enemy comes from the north, Sir Knight. I am also advised by this irritating pixie to inform you that there is a still-occupied childcare center in its path with a number of young mortals inside.
I clenched my jaw so hard that I chipped a tooth.
I looked around. Sonya was ordering the volunteers, but it would take time for him to get it done. If I shouted, "Follow me," and started moving, I'd probably just walk them into a meat grinder. Sonya needed more time to get the volunteers organized.
Harry?
Murphy asked. Get the bike, I said. She swung around and did.
Butters, Alphas, on me, I barked. Sonya, incoming from the north. Get them organized first, then bring them after me. I'll try to slow the Fomor down.
Go!
Sonya shouted. He turned and started bawling at the troops in a voice that could have been heard a quarter mile away. Murphy rumbled up on her bike and I swung a leg over. Will and Georgia loped out of the darkness and took up position on one side of the bike, and Andy and Marcy took the other. Butters came trotting over. You'd never have guessed the little guy had been galloping all over the damn town all evening from the spring in his step. I had to give it up to him. Butters was never going to be a powerhouse, but the little guy didn't have an atom of quit anywhere in him. From the north, maybe 2 or 3 blocks away, I heard the scream of huntsmen's spear blasts and a sudden sonic razor blade of ripping, tearing sound that was the simultaneous war cry of a dozen Malks going into battle. And then, flattening that sound, was the bone-shaking blare of a Jotun's horn, the same one from before. And my stomach fell out. Because shotguns are not going to help against something that big, no matter how many of them we had. It'd only make it mad. Hear me, Winter, I thought. Converge on that engagement. Kill anything that tries to harm those children. The air was suddenly split with the screams and battle cries of ogres and gnomes, Malks and black dogs, the wild ululations of a couple of wild she, the strangled moan of a freaking rawhead, and the chittering screech of some of those damn big spiders that had been such a pain in my ass on several occasions, as they all leapt forward at their fastest pace to find and destroy the enemy. Murphy gave me a wide-eyed look, glanced down and back, and then set her jaw.
Go!
I shouted. The Harley roared. And with monsters as our vanguard, off we went to be Jotun slayers.
Chapter 20.
We heard the sound of gunfire ahead, a lone pistol firing measured shots. Its defiance sounded thin against the shrieks of the huntsman's spear blasts. Cut the engine, I said. Murphy goosed a little more power out of the throttle and then cut the Harley's engine. The heavy bike rolled forward almost silently on momentum, and we had time to see what was happening. A single man, defended the doorway of a staircase that led up to the second level. A sign posted beside him read, "Third Watch Child Care." He wasn't terribly tall, but almost unbelievably stout, and with a shock I recognized Detective Bradley from Internal Affairs. A howling blast from a spear blew an inch of stonework off the doorway next to Bradley, and though chips of stone cut into his scalp, he didn't flinch as he sighted down the barrel of his service pistol and squeezed off his shot. One of the huntsman's heads jerked back and the creature fell to join three others on the ground, and those remaining screamed and swelled in size. The slide of the pistol locked back as the huntsman charged the doorway. Bradley calmly discarded the weapon, reached for his ankle, drew his back up, and put three rounds from a little revolver into the lead huntsman's chest as it charged. The thing staggered and thrust its spear at Bradley. The blocky man slapped the weapon aside with one hand, seized the haft in one thick fist, jammed the pistol up under the huntsman's jaw, and emptied the little revolver, sending the thing crashing and thrashing to the ground. Bradley, half his face masked in blood, dropped the empty revolver, took up the spear in a grip that showed me he knew something about using one, faced the remaining huntsman, and screamed, "Come on!" They roared back, the cries like a pack of beasts, none of them the same species. Five dead huntsmen. Bradley had picked a good position to fight from, surrounded in stone, slight elevation from the street, good cover. But he was out of ammo now, bleeding, and the remaining huntsman would only be that much stronger and more difficult to hurt. And still, he planted his feet.
"Come on, you ugly bastards!"
"That son of a bitch beat me in every tournament I ever fought him," Murphy said. "Harry." "Winter," I thought. "Take the huntsman." The ogres went in first, simply leaping from adjacent rooftops, huge white-furred things like River's shoulders, if he'd been a smoker since childhood, after a heroin bender. Though lean and seedy-looking, they were still enormous, viciously strong, and unremittedly savage. One of them landed on the huntsman with a three-story atomic elbow and crushed it with a great crackling of breaking bones. The other landed on a planted spear that went in its chest and burst through its back in a welter of gore and silver flame. The ogre shrieked like a demon as the huntsman arced the spear to one side and brought the dying winter fae crashing down to the street. Maux yowled like a herd of chainsaws and came bounding in from all angles. The huntsman's spears howled and sent some of the murderous beasts to whatever hell waited for them, but there were simply not enough of them to target the streaking forms of the Maux. They overbore two of the huntsmen and buried them in a mound of thick fur and frenzied claws, sharper than exacto knives. The huntsman died screaming. Beside them, a troop of gnomes had emerged from an alley and flung a dozen hatchets at another huntsman, even as it swelled in size and power. The wickedly sharp weapons hit with savage effect, setting the huntsman staggering, and black dogs flashed past, fangs raking and tore through its hamstrings. Once it was at ground level, the gnomes, chestnut-skinned, white-haired little guys, maybe 2.5 or 3 feet high, had no problems reaching its vitals. One of the remaining huntsmen turned to flee, only to confront the raw head coming out of the alley. The fey beast, made of bones of slaughtered animals and foes, was an enormous form under a great black cloak. The cloak flared out, and the bulky body of the raw head, made of hundreds of sharpened bones, began to contort and shriek in a sound uncomfortably like that of a meat grinder. The raw head seized the huntsman and dragged it beneath its cloak. Its bones rent and tore where I couldn't see it, and the huntsman screamed in fury. And then there was a lot of blood and sausage tumbling out from beneath the raw head's cloak and piling up on the huntsman's feet and lower legs. The last huntsman roared, rearing up in size, and the second largest Malk I'd ever seen, the size of a mountain lion but far bulkier, flew like an arrow for the creature's face. Gray Malkin's forepaws spread out to snowshoe proportions and sprouted 2-inch claws that latched into the huntsman's face. The elder Malk sank its jaws into one of the huntsman's eyes, gripping on like a vice to an orbital bone beneath. And thus braced, the supernaturally powerful swift cat began to rake with its rear claws. In less than a second, the last huntsman's throat looked like 20 or 30 pounds of pulled pork soaked in ketchup. The elder Malk flung himself aside as the huntsman, not even yet fully grown into the size of the ones we'd had to kill, dropped limply to the ground, gushing blood like a broken water main. Gray Malkin landed not 10 feet in front of the Harley, flicked each set of claws once fastidiously, and said, in an utterly unnerving feline voice,
"Sir Knight, Elder Gray Malkin, reporting for duty."
"Jesus, Mary, Mother of God," Murphy breathed. Gray Malkin flattened his ears and gave Murphy a glower, then turned to me and said,
"There are multiple war bands on the adjoining streets. My kin kept them occupied for now. We are badly outnumbered, Sir Knight. Retreat would be ideal before..."
The Jatun's horn blared. In the haze and among the buildings, it was impossible to tell where it was, other than... "Close," Murphy breathed.
"Before that,"
Gray Malkin said sourly.
"Well done, Elder," I said, "but we're getting those kids out,"
the Malk growled.
"We cannot contest a Jatun, Sir Knight."
"Pussy,"
Murphy said. I blinked at her. She smirked. "Too good. Couldn't resist." Gray Malkin's fur bristled and his weight shifted slightly. Without breaking her smirk, Murphy swept her pistol out and covered the Malk as quick as blinking.
"Steel-jacketed rounds tonight, friend," she advised. "Play nice."
Gray Malkin growled at Murphy, eyed me, then relaxed as if nothing had happened. He flexed the claws out of his right forepaw and regarded them idly, ignoring Murphy completely. She put the gun away and returned the favor, but she never quite let the Malk out of her sight. They'd get on fine. I swung off the bike. Murphy followed. I beckoned Butters and the Alphas.
"We're getting those kids out first," I said, walking. "Gray Malkin, you and Winter keep a corridor open for us, back to the defenses."
"We cannot hold it long,"
Gray Malkin warned me.
"Do it," I said over my shoulder. "Go."
The elder Malk made a throaty, ugly sound and vanished before it could even complete turning away. I came upon the entry to the daycare center stairwell to find Bradley gripping his spear and standing braced in the doorway, his eyes very, very wide. The spear was already degrading and flaking away. It had be gone in a few more minutes.
"Hey, Detective Bradley, it's, me, Harry Dresden. Remember?"
The blocky man stared at me, then he jerked his head in a nod.
"Murph," I said.
She stepped past me, her hands out.
"Hey, hey, Brian. You with me, buddy?"
Bradley stared at her for a second and then lowered the spear a little. "We aren't buddies, Sergeant. You kind of hate my guts." Murphy looked from the liquefying forms of the slain huntsman to Bradley.
"That was then. This is now."
He blinked.
"What the hell are you talking about?"
He twitched as the wolves and Butters brought up the rear.
"What the hell is happening?"
"Hi,"
Butters said and waved.
"Hi," said Bradley. He blinked. "Dr. Butters?"
"You know all that stuff I told you in closed session that you thought was bullshit?" Murphy asked.
"And all that stuff I told you in closed session that you thought was bullshit,"
Butters added brightly. The blocky detective looked from the dead huntsman and the fallen fey back to Murphy and Butters.
"Jesus Christ."
Bradley handled it pretty well. He got a little whiter around the eyes for a couple of seconds, and then he closed them firmly, set his jaw, and adjusted visibly.
"Fuck it, I'll lose my mind later," he said.
And when he opened his eyes again, he had his cop face on.
"I've got 6 kids, a nice old lady, and a Rudolph up there. How do we get them out?"
Back to Millennium Park, I said. We're keeping a corridor open. Send them west from there. Shrieks and howls burst out around us as Winter launched an attack upon enemy forces. Huntsmen howled and their spears wailed. In the background, but closer, came the thunder of the Eye claiming another building. Get the kids out now, Murphy said. Bradley tensed his jaw, nodded, dropped the spear, and pounded up the stairway. He paused by the door, flattening himself against the wall, and called, "It's Bradley," before he opened it with one hand, staying well clear.
"Bradley,"
came Rudolph's voice. It was panicky. Rudolph had run into monsters a couple of times. Granted, both of those times had been bad, but he'd been like a lot of people who'd run into the supernatural. He just couldn't handle it. Maybe that was a personal shortcoming. Or maybe he'd just been born without the capacity to face that kind of terrifying reality. Either way, it made it harder to like him, especially at times like this. "It's me," he said.
"Damn it, Bradley!"
Rudolph screamed.
"It's me, sir,"
Bradley said, his voice heavy with patience.
"Get in here! Get undercover!"
"We've got to get out of here while we can," Bradley said. "Get the kids. We've got to go."
"Are you crazy?"
Rudolph demanded.
"It's a war zone out there."
I leaned in and shouted up the stairwell.
"It's going to be a war zone right in there with you if you don't get moving, Rudolph."
"Dresden?"
"Yes, it's me, moron," I said in my grumpiest wizard voice. "And we're not going to be able to get out for much longer, you knucklehead, so move it."
"This is your doing,"
Rudolph squealed.
"More of your lies."
Bradley got a peculiar expression on his face. I wasn't sure what it was exactly, though you could probably have captioned the photo, "How could I have been so blind?" He held up one finger to me, then he walked in through the door. There was a thump and a clatter. Bradley emerged from the daycare with Rudolph draped limply over one shoulder and the man's pistol in his own shoulder holster. He was carrying a small child, maybe 2 years old, in the other arm. Behind him came a woman with steely hair and a grandmother's clothing. She held an infant in the cradle of one arm and the hand of a small string of larger children who followed her, all holding hands. Bradley led them down the stairs and onto the street. Butters immediately went to take the infant from the older woman, who surrendered the child with a grateful grimace and a twitch of her shoulder. The wolves immediately took position around the children without me telling them to. They wagged their tails and took little happy steps and generally performed the canine equivalent of pinching their cheeks and making a fuss over them. The kids were instantly enchanted by the group of doggies, who also did their best to keep their furry bodies between the children's eyes and the worst of the horrors around us. They felt like I did, that no one should have to look at that kind of thing, and that those of us who already had, we were glad when we could spare someone else the same invisible wounds. I fell in beside Bradley, who carried his own weight and that of two other souls without visible effort. "The wolves are great kids. They'll go with you, get you and the kids out. 2 blocks south to the park. There are volunteers holding out at the pavilion. Tell them that the wizard sent you to see Sonya. He's a big black Russian guy. Tell him I want him to give you an escort out. South, pavilion. Sonya, wizard send me, get the kids out," Bradley confirmed. He eyed the wolves. "Friendlies?" "Yeah," I said. He heaved a breath, then set his jaw, nodded, and said, "Got it." "Good man," I said. "You're handling this well." "I am not," Bradley said without slowing his steps. "I am not.
"Then you're freaking out in the most useful way possible," I said. "Keep it up." Bradley stared at me for a second. Then he let out a bark of crack-voiced laughter. But it was a real laugh. He hoisted Rudolph into a slightly more comfortable position on one wide, thick shoulder. Rudolph let out a groan of protest neither of us listened to and kept walking. "Butters,"
I said, slowing my steps for a moment to drop even with the little knight.
It's kids, Harry, he said. He showed me the hilt of Philocius, carried in the hand that wasn't holding a baby. I'll take care of them.
I squeezed his shoulder. And the ground shook. We traded a wide-eyed look, and I said, get them out. Go.
Harry?
Murphy shouted from behind me. The ground shook again. Bradley staggered and fell. He curled his body around the child to shield her, which meant that I'm afraid Rudolph took the brunt of it, the poor man. The gun hadn't been strapped into Bradley's holster, and it clattered onto the street. I whirled, feet spread wide for balance, as a pair of comets shot out of a side street half a block up, whirling in an evasive helix in the haze, as the damn Jotun from before, bruised and bloodied and furious, swiped its axe at them.
My lord, trumpeted Toot Toot, I have engaged the enemy.
The axe nearly split my major general in twain, but the second glowing globe hit him at the last second as Lacuna slammed a shoulder into his, causing them both to veer out of the weapon's way.
Pay attention, fool,
she screamed. The Jotun saw us and dropped into a low slide, legs spread wide like a surfer, slamming its axe into the street and dragging it behind like some berserk plow, rending the street with an enormous roar of breaking concrete and blacktop as it used the weapon to slow its enormous momentum so that it could turn toward us. The ground shook under the violence of the Jotun's very presence. I rubbernecked to see Bradley struggling to rise. Butters was hurrying the nice old lady and the children along, but their best pace wasn't a fast walk, and they were all in plain sight of the Jotun, utterly vulnerable. Right. That made my choice simple. Suicidal, but simple. I turned to fight. Murphy sprinted past me and behind me as the Jotun roared and raised its axe from the street. As if in tandem with its rising fury, the axe burst into flame. The Jotun roared, flexed muscles the size of European automobiles, moved with the technique perfect to use the full force of its unthinkably powerful body, and flung the axe, spinning parallel to the ground like the blade of a lawnmower. What must have been at least half a ton of hard, sharp, burning metal came whirling toward my freaking face. Chapter 21. It is often surprising to people to discover exactly how strong a human being can be if he knows what he's doing. The Jotun knew what he was doing. Given the raw power behind that throw, there was no way I was going to stop it. I could put every inch of power I had into a shield and be unable to stop that axe's edge. But I might be able to deflect it. I summoned my will and rammed it into the shield bracelet on my left wrist. It hissed and popped with stray sparks of green-gold power as the energy of my magic met the inefficiencies in the material and the spells carved into the copper bracelet, and the thing heated up almost immediately as I brought a shimmering plane into being in front of me. And then I dropped to one knee and tilted the shield back, way back, into a slope of maybe 20 degrees. The giant axe hit my shield in an explosion of kinetic and magical energy, literally. There was an explosion centered where the shield and the axe met, and I realized with a belated shock that the Jotun had imbued considerable power of its own into the axe. The world went white and silent. I was flung a good 15 feet back across the ground and wound up slamming into Bradley, who was only then getting moving again. Rudolph, tragically, got roughed up again as a result. Oh no. I lay there for a second, stunned, and watched glass from hundreds of shattered windows fall with almost dreamy slowness toward the ground. My bracelet burned hot enough to scald skin, and the winter mantle sent me pulses of weird, tingly sensations to let me know what was going on. I shook my head and looked around blearily. The axe had hit my shield at an odd angle and skittered off to my left and up. It was buried to the eye in what looked like an office building, as if an enormous lumberjack had sunk it in so that he could spit on his hands and get to work. Oh, right. The Jotun.
I drove my staff into the ground and shoved myself to my feet, shaking my head in an attempt to get the damn bells to stop ringing. The ground shook as I did. I looked up to find the Jotun standing maybe 20 yards away, scowling down at me. It tilted its enormous head and studied me for a few seconds. Then, in a voice so deep I could barely understand the word, it rumbled,
"Saitamata."
"What the hell?" I faced it and said, "Jotun." Its brow furrowed with cold anger. His skin was ruddy, his features rough-hewn, and his eyes were an almost violent shade of green grass within the shadows of his helm. From this close, I could see the enormous ugly scarring around his mouth, faded with time, but lumpy and displeasing nonetheless.
"Who are you, and what have you done that I might know whom I kill?"
Oh, right. Old school Viking. I'd been recognized as someone worth fighting, and now it was time to boast, which suited me fine. I had people who needed time to escape. I glanced back over my shoulder to where Bradley was struggling to rise, cradling the child with great care and tenderness inside the circle of his torn and bleeding arms, and with a shock, I realized why he'd been at that daycare center in the first place. The little girl was his. Oh, God. If Maggie was on this street right now, I'd be losing my mind with terror for her. Bradley staggered up drunkenly and then turned to Rudolph, who was stirring feebly.
"Get the girl out," I said in a low, intense voice. "She's more important. I'll take care of Rudy."
Bradley hesitated. Of course. No good cop leaves his partner behind. But Bradley had seen some awful things that night, and he made the choice most fathers would. He picked up his little girl and ran to get her clear. I turned back to the Jotun and drew myself up to my full height, which meant I was eye to lower quadriceps with him.
"I am Harry, son of Malcolm," I shouted back. "I have battled dark sorcerers and black knights. I have fought men and beasts in numbers too great for counting, invaded the heart of winter, confronted necromancers and the living dead, vampires and ghouls and demons in their hordes endless. I have matched wits with the six queens of faerie and prevailed, and thwarted the combined will of the White Council. When they came for my child, I smote the Red Court of Vampires and laid them in ruin for all the world to see. I am Harry, son of Malcolm, and I have entered the vaults of Tartarus and stolen its treasures beneath the gaze of Hades himself. And I'm about to add giant slaying to my resume."
That seemed to please the Jotun immensely. His smile grew wider and wider, showing more and more teeth the size of dinner plates.
"Impressive claims."
"Damn right," I shouted back. "Who are you, and what do you got?"
The Jotun lifted his hand. There was a groan of concrete and steel breaking. And then that damned huge axe just flew back into his hand as if it had been drawn by a cartoon magnet.
"I am Svangar, son of Svangi," the Jotun roared back.
He used one hand to gesture toward his scarred mouth, infusing it with contempt.
"I have fought the Odin son and lived to tell the tale."
I swallowed. I didn't know much about Thor beyond what stories, comics, and movies tell. But from what I understood, he was pretty much the Jotnar's boogeyman. If this particular Jotun had survived that boss fight, it was probably safe to assume he was no pushover. Worse, I had hoped to keep his attention longer while he bawled his boasts in my face. Just my luck. I had probably found the one Jotun in the universe who had a humble brag of that magnitude. You couldn't not use that one to boast. My mouth was pretty dry. I didn't reply. I just nodded. Svangar nodded back. Then he roared and came at me, axe whirling.
The thing about creatures as big as the Jotun is that they come without power steering. There was simply too much mass building, too much momentum for them to be quick to alter course. Their whole life must be like walking on a sheet of slippery ice. Not only that, but nervous systems are nervous systems. Signals that have to travel a maximum of 6 feet are going to be faster than ones that have to cover 20. I had to make that advantage count. If I could dance fast enough, maybe I could maneuver Svangar into tripping into a building or something and run before he got loose. With the reach that axe gave him, there was no way to get around him without coming into range, and I did not want to do that. One hit from that thing, and I'd look like a Rorschach test image. So I ran right at him. Svangar bellowed a war cry as the axe came down toward me. I pointed my staff to one side, focused my will, and screamed, "Forzare!" Even magic can't escape a lot of fundamental physics. Project force at something and it pushes back with an equal and opposite reaction. I used a lot of force, slamming against a brick building to my right. The building slammed me back, and the impact sent me flying to one side and out from under the axe. The axe cleaved into the asphalt where I'd been a second before. I flew sideways and forward, dropping into a roll as I came down to the ground. The giant roared, his momentum taking him into his own axe. The handle jabbed him in the gut with a whoosh of expelled air that sounded like a miniature gale. I made my feet again and darted up the streets a dozen paces to force the Jotun to face me and turn his back on the escapees. Svangar wasn't a dummy, though. He knew he was slower. So he twisted his blazing axe, melted a bunch of the street's asphalt into a blob of burning tar that could have filled a small hot tub, and flung it at me even before he begun to turn. I dodged that one easily enough, but Svangar had never intended to turn me into a living, screaming tar baby. As the Jotun turned, he simply seized a disabled car in one hand and flung it at me sidearm at the speed of a major league fastball. I brought up my shield in time, angling it to my left as I darted right. The car hit the shield, which flared into nearly coherent green-gold light. Broken glass and fiberglass and metal flew out from the impact. The smashed car spun wildly away, but even so, Isaac Newton had his two bits. I was knocked to my right, staggered, and had to put a hand on the street to keep from falling. I recovered my balance, drew my blasting rod from my coat, slammed my will through it, and shouted, "Fuego!" The raw energy of the terrified city supercharged my spell. A beam of molten gold energy that lashed out from its tip, as bright as any arc welder's fire, forced me to close my eyes and turn away from its intensity in the smoldering ember light of the burning city, and left a blazon of blue-purple light across the insides of my eyelids. I blinked them open again frantically to find the Jotun eyeing me with a large section of the mail over his heart glowing deep orange.
"A little flame like that," rumbled the Jotun, "against a son of Muspelheim?"
Damn it. Fire was my go-to, exactly because it usually did the trick. The Jotun snorted contemptuously. Then he swung his axe broadside at a building, which put up about as much resistance as dandelions do to machetes, and sent a cloud of broken glass and concrete and steel at me. I lifted my arm to cover my face and brought up my shield. Broken glass rattled against the spell-armored sleeve of my duster. One piece got by and my ear suddenly went hot and tingly. The rest slammed into my shield and drove me back until I hit the hood of a parked car, taking my legs out from under me and sending me crashing to my back on the sidewalk. My heart slammed with terror. This wasn't a fight. It was an earthquake, and I was running around in the middle of it like a damn fool. Svangar took a couple of huge strides and the axe came down. I braced the end of my staff against the hollow of my shoulder, the way I would have a rifle, and screamed, "Forzare!" The air was too thick with energy that night. I'd given the spell a lot more than I meant to. The staff kicked back against me like a mule. I heard my shoulder re-dislocate with an audible tearing sound and a burst of pain static, but I held on
and was flung violently away from the descending axe. I fetched up against another car, hard enough to drive the wind right out of me. The Jotun turned his axe sideways like a fly swatter, took a stride toward me, and raised it. And that was when I saw Bradley vanish into the haze, the last of the company of escapees. But Murphy hadn't gone with them. She was standing next to her Harley, and the box labeled camping supplies was wide open. I watched her draw out a round tube with a couple of grip points and a control pad painted olive drab. She extended the tube, flipped up some kind of little doohickey on it, lifted it to her freaking shoulder, and settled her fingers lightly on the control pad.
"You fight like a woman, Sidamada," Svangar snarled.
"Hey, Dritseka!" Murphy shouted. Svangar turned his head toward her, his expression furious. One corner of her mouth crooked up in a smile, and her blue eyes were cold.
"Me too."
And she fired the weapon. I don't know a lot about military hardware, but if you're going to fight a Jotun, it seems to me a bazooka is about the right caliber. I didn't really see the rocket fly. It's not how those things work. They move at about the speed of a handgun bullet. There was simply an explosion, followed almost instantaneously by another explosion in the hollow of Svangar's throat. Crack, boom. Resisting fire is a nifty trick, but in the end, again, Sir Isaac will always weigh in on matters. Fire is an absolute, a collection point of energy, and it can always get hotter. Eventually, as with any defense, there's a limit to what it can do, a point of catastrophic failure. And Murphy's rocket found that limit. Ever see a watermelon get smashed with a sledgehammer? It was sort of like that. Flesh and blood exploded from the Jotun in a cloud of aerial chum. I could see Svangar's cracked and blackened collarbone and his freaking spine through the hole in his neck. The Jotun staggered, his shoulders smashing into a building, raised his axe one last time, and fell as it dropped from his suddenly nerveless fingers. The giant's body crushed two cars and knocked over a street light as it came down. One outflung hand landed not 3 feet from my toes. And suddenly, the street was silent and very still. I got up and walked toward her, taking slow steps wide around the fallen Jotun. It was a little difficult to keep my balance. I might not have been able to feel it, but the pain was taking a physical toll on me. My entire body tingled unpleasantly. "Fight like a woman, my ass," Murphy muttered darkly, glowering at the dead giant. She stood there with the rocket launcher on her shoulder and one hand on her hip and grinned at me as I came close. "Seriously?" I asked. "A bazooka?"
"Had two. The other one was my practice launch," she said.
"You never told me about it."
Her grin widened. "No, you great gawking man-child. You'd have wanted to play with it." I put a hand over my heart and gave her a wounded look.
"Ow.
Truth hurts, huh?"
"Dredseka?" I asked her.
"Norwegian for, scumbag," she said. Then she glanced at my expression and said, "I'm a cop, Harry. There's tradition to consider." Before I could respond, Rudolph's panicky voice screamed,
"Both of you, don't move. Don't either of you scumbags move a fucking muscle."
I blinked and looked to one side. Rudolph had a shiner on his jawline that had already swollen into a proper mouse. He was standing on his feet, wobbling, his face pasty, and his eyes wide and confused. His suit was torn and wrinkled and sprinkled with bits of blood from what appeared to be a broken nose. But he was in a weaver stance, had recovered his gun from where Bradley had lost it, and had the weapon leveled at Murphy.
"Terrorist," he gabbled. "You're a goddamn terrorist."
"Rudolph," Murphy said, "you don't know what's going on." The whites of his eyes got bigger.
"You just killed someone with a rocket launcher."
Murphy eyed the fallen Jawtoon.
That was the idea, yeah. Hey, Rudolph, I said. Easy. Look, we can't be here for very long. There's more of the enemy coming. We all need to go.
Shut up,
Rudolph screamed, tracking the gun to me.
Shut the fuck up, you lowlife!
I began to lift a hand, to flick a wave of force at him, to take the gun out of his hand. But I didn't. I looked at my arm. I told it to rise. It ignored me. I couldn't tell what was going on behind the cloud of static flooding my nervous system. Christ, that was the shoulder I'd dislocated again, without being able to sense the pain of the injury I hadn't noticed.
Rudolph, Murphy said, her voice cracking with authority. We're trying to help you. Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, man. At least take your finger off the trigger.
Rudolph swung the weapon back to Murphy and began to shriek in a high-pitched voice, pushing the gun forward for emphasis.
I don't need you to...
The gun went off. The emptied rocket launcher fell to the street with a metallic clatter, spattered with scarlet. Murphy dropped like a stone.
Chapter 22. Rudolph stood there, shocked at the sudden noise. He stared at the gun, then at Murphy.
What? Medic!
I screamed, rushing forward.
Medic! Medic!
Murphy lay on the street behind her motorcycle. One knee had bent so that she was lying on her lower leg. The emptied rocket launcher was still rocking where it fell. I knelt over her. Her eyes were open wide as she stared up. The fire of the eye flared again, briefly turned the world scarlet. I didn't care. I ripped her jacket and shirt open.
The bullet had gone into her neck, a quarter of an inch above her Kevlar vest. It hadn't gone straight through. It had begun tumbling when it hit, and had come out under and behind her left ear, leaving a trail of ravaged flesh in its wake. Blood came out, as from a fountain. Karen, I said. Oh, God.
I ripped the duster off, tore my shirt in my haste to get it off over my head, wrapped it into a pad, and put pressure on the gaping wound. As long as I didn't try to move it at the shoulder, my injured arm functioned a little. I could use both hands.
Medic!
There was so much blood. It soaked my shirt through. I heard footsteps running toward us.
Karen, I'm here, I said. Help is coming. Hang on.
She coughed, blood.
Harry, she said. Her lips went red with blood when she said my name. Her voice was ragged.
I'm here, I said.
It was hard to see her. The world had gone blurry.
I'm here.
The blood was making a pool around her golden hair. The running footsteps came to a sudden stop. Murphy made a couple of gurgling, choking sounds. I looked up to see Waldo Butters standing 10 feet away, staring at Murphy. His face said everything.
No, I said.
No, Karen.
Come on, Karen.
She looked up at me for a second, and the corners of her eyes wrinkled as she smiled weakly. Her face had gone gray. Her lips were blue.
Not from you. I like Murph from you.
Okay, I said. I could barely choke the words. Murph.
She reached across her chest and weakly touched my hand with hers.
Harry, she said. I love. Her eyes were on mine, and I couldn't look away. I felt the soul gaze begin, and I saw the flame of a candle go out. Her eyes emptied, just emptied, like the windows of an abandoned house. One moment, her body had been gasping for breath, straining, her face full of pain and confusion. Then it was just an empty house.
No,
I said.
No, no.
I bent over her airway, breathing, circulation. I opened her mouth, tried to make sure it was clear, but it was pooled with blood. I couldn't see her then. I was weeping. I bent over her anyway, breathed into her mouth.
Harry?
Butter said. His voice creaked. I breathed in 5 deep breaths, tasted blood. Keep the pressure. Butters knelt down, his body moving on autopilot, his face stunned. He put his hands over the pad. I did compressions. On an empty house. I leaned down to breathe for Murphy again, then more compressions.
Harry,
Butters said.
Harry.
5 breaths, compressions. It was hard work. In a couple of minutes, I felt dizzy as hell.
Harry, you can't, Butters said. You can't.
Come on,
I screamed.
Murph, come on.
I breathed for her again. I broke a rib on the next compression. But it didn't matter. It was nothing but an empty house. I felt Butters put his hands on my wrists. He drew them gently away.
Harry, he said, his voice thick. Harry, even if she'd been on a table when it happened.
I didn't look away from her face, from her eyes. I'd been too afraid to soul gaze Murph. Everyone who had done that with me had seen something that didn't please them. I'd been afraid to lose her, and I'd never allowed it. Now, it was too late. The eyes are the windows of the soul. And Murphy's eyes were just the windows of an empty house. There was nothing inside to gaze upon. I put my forehead against hers and wept helplessly. I screamed in rage and denial as I did. I knew the sound was ugly, was hardly human. I felt Butters' hand on my shoulder.
Harry, we've got to go. We have to.
I shook him off with a violent twist of my shoulders. She was gone. Murphy was gone. And the winter mantle did nothing, did less than nothing for the pain. I put my hand on her hair. Her head was still warm. I could still smell her shampoo. Beneath all the iron scent of her blood. I felt myself start to scream again, but I grabbed onto that scream and coldly choked it to death. I leaned down and kissed her forehead, closing my eyes, felt the pain rising in me, and I embraced it, welcomed it. I watched the futures I hoped we would have die before my eyes. I let the pain burn away, everything non-essential. When I opened my eyes again and looked up, the world had gone grayscale, except for Rudolph. Rudolph was bathed in light the color of Murphy's blood. He flinched as my gaze fell on him. Butters got what was happening. Somewhere in the distance, I heard him say in a warning tone, Harry, Harry, what are you doing? Rudolph began taking terrified steps back. He pointed the gun at me, and I couldn't have cared less.
Wait, I didn't mean to...
I rose.
Harry, no,
Butters said sharply. Rudolph turned and ran. That made things simple. I took off after my prey. Chapter 23. Hate is comforting.
Hate is pure. There aren't any questions, any worries about right and wrong, any quibbles about your motivations or goals. There are no doubts. Hate is serene. Rudolph ran. I pursued. And when I caught him, I would kill him. Horribly. Nothing else entered into it.
I'll give the guy this much credit. He could move. He'd always been careful about his looks, and evidently that meant a lot of cardio as well as expensive suits. He ran well. But he didn't have my focus, my clarity. And he hadn't been running himself half to death every morning for months and months. He was human. He felt pain. It was an enormous disadvantage. I gained. He made funny sounds as he ran, little gasps and whimpers. He was terrified. He should have been. In a city of monsters, he just pissed off one of the worst. He took a right turn into a little loading area behind a building, tried a door, and found it locked. Obviously. Everyone who wasn't running was fording up. There were more monsters than unlocked doors in Chicago that night. I don't know what he was thinking. He turned from the door, desperate, lifted his gun, and started shooting at me as fast as he could pull the trigger. I raised my shield and slowed to a walk. Some of the shots went wide, some bounced off the shield. None of them threatened me.
"You can't!"
Rudolph screamed. He fumbled at his armpit and withdrew another magazine.
"You can't!"
Before he could reload, I just walked forward into him, holding up the shield, and smashed him back against the steel door behind him. Then I set my legs against the ground and started pushing. Rudolph made a short, high-pitched sound of pain. The shield caught the barrel of his gun and forced it one way, his wrist another. The idiot still had his finger locked on the trigger. I heard the finger break.
"Dresden? No!"
Rudolph screamed. I pushed harder. Fire might have been good, but my damn arm would make it difficult. This felt better. Felt right. I thought about saying something about grinding his bones to make my bread, but I didn't feel like conversation at that moment. Besides, why waste breath on a corpse? We were in pandemonium. No one was going to ask questions about one more body. I pushed harder. Rudolph tried to scream again. There wasn't enough room between my shield and the metal door for his lungs to expand all the way, so it came out breathy and weak. His eyes were wide and terrified, I noted, but that was to be expected. He was dying, after all. A sour scent of urine filled the air. I took note of it and adjusted my feet slightly so that I could lean in harder. He went for his phone, of all the stupid things. His goddamn phone. As if anything there would do him any good. As if it would function and let him call for help. As if it would arrive in time to do him any good. The phone fell from his fingers as he tried to gasp for breath. I saw in his face when he realized what was going to happen. When the panic took him and the tears. When his hope faltered and died. It made me feel something hot and sweet deep in my guts. You killed her. Feel what I feel, you bastard. My teeth were bared. I felt sick and hollow and strong. I pushed harder. I heard a bone break. I didn't care where it might have been. I just liked the sound and wanted to hear more of it.
"Bože moj," came a sudden, startled voice from somewhere behind me. "Dresden, what is the meaning of this?"
"Fuck off, Sonya," I snarled. "Won't be a minute."
Rudolph made a gurgling sound.
"Dresden," Sonya said. His deep voice was troubled, which stood to reason. He didn't have much clarity like I did. "He is no threat to you. Stop this."
"He killed Murphy," I said. My voice sounded calm. "I'm going to balance those scales real quick. Then we'll get to work."
"No," Sonya said. "That is not your place."
I heard the steel in his voice. I turned my head slowly and looked at him.
The Knight of Hope drew Asparagus from his side. The saber gleamed with a harsh, threatening light in the dimness of the alleyway.
"Let him go," Sonya said. "You are killing a man. If he has done wrong, he will face justice, but not like this."
"Just a second," I said, as if I were putting together a sandwich. Sonya's expression was strange. I couldn't track what it was, but I knew it wasn't appropriate to the situation. He stalked closer, moving well, very well. He was a more worthy opponent.
"Harry Dresden, I will not ask again."
Something disturbed the purity of my hatred then. I couldn't tell what it was, but it pissed me off. What had been a profoundly pure experience had been disrupted. This creature, this Rudolph, didn't deserve even the death I was about to give him. He couldn't even die properly, forcing me to work for it. He was beyond contempt.
"Walk away, Sonya," I said shortly. "This is happening."
Sonya wouldn't walk away. That wasn't the knight's style. He wasn't going to let me finish my business. I would have to reason with him. Sonya closed his eyes for a second, as if in pain. Which, come on, that was just stupid. I dropped the shield, whipped toward him, and kicked him in the balls. I was fast and strong, but Sonya had been fighting for his life against various bad guys for a while now and wasn't going to be taken down by a sucker punch. He managed to move his hips at the last second, taking some of the impact out of the kick. So instead of dropping him to the ground, the blow knocked him back and staggered him, but he kept his feet. I gave Sonya no time to recover. I followed up, inside the reach of Asparagus, getting my left forearm across his right, driving his arm back and up and not letting it come back down. He was big and strong. I was bigger, stronger. I crowded him against a wall, drove my knee up into his belly once, twice, hard enough to break boards. Then the Russian's head snapped forward into my face. There was a burst of static pain in the general area of my head, and then I was on my way back across the alley. My shoulders hit the wall hard. There was a crackling noise, a flash of heat in my shoulder, and then I could move my right arm readily again. Sonya had driven a fist like a sledgehammer twice into my belly by the time I caught his blow with my right forearm before a third could land. I stomped down as hard as I could on one of his feet, with mixed results. A Russian had worn steel-toed work boots. He staggered a little and threw a knee at my groin. I blocked it with one thigh, the one I'd hurt earlier, and the world narrowed to a tunnel for a second before I twisted my head to one side, found his ear, and bit down as hard as I could. Sonya screamed, and his weight shifted back. I used that change of weight, set my legs, and drove him across the alleyway with the full power of my body and the strength of the winter night. He hit the wall with a vicious impact. I felt it drive the air from his lungs, and I let out a shout of triumph as he bounced off, stunned for maybe all of a second. I hit him hard 3 times in that second, driving my fist into the side of his neck, into the base of his jaw, under the ear, and into his temple. Wham! 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 A sword fell out of his hand. The Russian toppled. He hit the ground, stunned, making gagging sounds.
Self-righteous.